Coming up, Lucky Severson on the huge welfare program of the Mormon Church. Also, Fred DeSamlazaro on Quaker conscientious objectors who avoided the draft in the U.S. and moved to help develop the lush forests of Costa Rica. Plus, for Ramadan, Muslims sponsoring a project called Bring a Friend to Mosque.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week of controversy from the European Union to the U.S. presidential campaign. Republican presumptive nominee Donald Trump held a closed-door meeting in New York with more than 1,000 evangelical leaders. At the same time, other faith groups protested his campaign. Kim Lawton reports.
As interfaith activists protested outside, some of the nation's most prominent conservative Christian leaders held what they called a conversation with Donald Trump.
There's no spirit in these inner cities.
The session was closed to the press, but some cell phone footage was posted on social media. Trump answered a series of pre-selected questions. He assured the group he would protect their religious freedom and appoint pro-life judges. He said his position on immigration is more nuanced than it's portrayed, and he claimed that he himself is a tremendous believer. Evangelicals are a key part of the GOP coalition, but they've been deeply divided over Trump. Organizers said the gathering helped many in their decision process.
I don't think people are leaving here with their minds made up, but I think they've moved the needle today, and I think now he has a little bit, growing, increasing wind in his sails from a grassroots standpoint.
Some evangelicals who were not at the meeting criticized those who were. Several Christian clergy said Trump does not represent them.
If Donald Trump wants to convince us that he shares our values, he's going to have to start talking about things like compassion, human dignity, and justice.
Other religious leaders criticized Trump's claim during the meeting that he and the public, quote, don't know anything about Hillary in terms of religion. The Faith Voters for Hillary Clinton PAC issued a statement citing Clinton's many discussions of her lifelong United Methodist faith.
Now, this is the day the Lord has made.
Meanwhile, the Jewish group Bend the Ark organized a series of interfaith vigils to protest what they called Trump's anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-woman, and violent agenda.
I think that this threat is real. I think it's a threat to our democracy in many ways.
This I pledge.
The group pledged that Trump will not become president on its watch. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
After the United Kingdom's vote to leave the European Union this week, Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby and Church of England Bishop John Santamu issued a joint statement urging their nation to, quote, remain hospitable and compassionate builders of bridges and not barriers. The U.S. Supreme Court announced this week that it had deadlocked in a case challenging President Obama's immigration plan. The split decision sets no national precedent, but leaves in place a lower court ruling that said the president lacks the authority to shield up to 4 million immigrants from deportation without approval from Congress. Many religious groups expressed disappointment with the ruling, calling it a major setback for immigrant families. In a separate decision, the Supreme Court handed affirmative action supporters a major victory. In a 4-3 vote, the court allowed a race-conscious admissions program at the University of Texas at Austin. Debate about new gun control measures stalled on Capitol Hill this week. Religious advocates of more gun restrictions were among those praising Democratic members for staging a sit-in on the House floor to protest Congress's lack of action. The sit-in was led by civil rights legend Congressman John Lewis, who's also a minister. Several groups praised what they called his and others' moral leadership. The Council on American-Islamic Relations released a new report that says record numbers of groups are spreading hatred of Muslims. The report lists 74 organizations that it considers anti-Islam. The report also noted that there were 78 attacks on mosques in 2015. The Muslim advocacy organization said some of the language of the 2016 presidential campaign is partly to blame for the rise in Islamophobia. In a continued effort to strengthen interfaith relations, Pope Francis is visiting Armenia this weekend. Francis is spending much of his time as a guest of the Armenian Apostolic Church. He's also visiting a monument dedicated to the estimated 1.5 million Armenians killed by Ottoman Turks starting in 1915. Last year, Francis reignited a diplomatic dispute with Turkey after he labeled the killings the first genocide of the 20th century. Leaders of the world's Eastern Orthodox churches have begun an historic meeting in Greece to discuss the church's role in the modern world. It was intended to be the first time in more than 1,000 years that all the self-governing branches of Eastern Orthodoxy came together. But at the last minute, 4 leaders decided not to come, including the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, the largest Orthodox branch. They cited differences over the agenda. Those at the meeting condemned that decision and vowed to keep seeking unity. Now, a Lucky Severson story on the successful welfare program of the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It supplies food, clothes, and all kinds of care to those in need, and almost all the workers are volunteers.
From the fields and the orchards to the factories, the canneries, the giant warehouses, hundreds of thousands of people from all over the world. This is the Mormon Church's welfare system. It's huge, it's impressive, and gets zero funding from the government. The managing director here is Steve Peterson.
The idea of caring for those who are in need, we consider to be a scriptural mandate.
A mandate, Mormons say, comes from the Bible and from Mormon scripture received through revelation to its prophets.
And that's grown into a wonderful program worldwide that focuses on caring for those who are in need, to relieve suffering and to foster self-reliance and to give opportunities for service, both for those that receive things and for those that are helping out.
That concept has grown to helping not only members, but non-members through humanitarian aid worldwide. And it's apparently been done very well. This is Richard Humphreys, the manager of the Bishop Storehouse.
We've had the Department of Defense, we've had the Army, the Navy, the Marines, FEMA. They've all come out and they says, wherever we go, we've been told, go see how the Mormons do it, because they're always the first ones on the site.
After Katrina smashed into New Orleans, Mormon convoys were the first to arrive with 450 truckloads.
As that hurricane was circling around in the Gulf of Mexico, we didn't know where it was going to come inland. So we formed a big semicircle that ran from Texas to South Carolina. And as soon as that hurricane hit New Orleans, those trucks were sent out and they were there within hours.
Those trucks have a beehive on the side, a symbol very important to Mormonism. It is said to represent industry, harmony, order, frugality, and the sweet results of toil. And these people are busy bees on the church's farms and ranches that are some of the largest in the U.S., in their canneries and processing plants. And the fruit of this labor is given away. Well, not exactly given. Those who can are required to work for it. Heber J. Grant, the prophet who started the welfare system during the Great Depression, said its purpose was to do away with the curse of idleness and to help people help themselves.
They're taking care of you okay?
Yes, thank you.
Bishop Paul Roberts is an attorney and a volunteer lay pastor.
Sometimes it helps them feel like they're worth something. I talk to some people and they don't feel like they're worth anything because they can't find a job, they can't provide for their family. And you ask them to go and do some service. They come here and they help at the storehouse, or you have them go and help and sort through clothes at the eye. Or it helps them to understand that they have value and they can contribute.
Betty Ambutu is a refugee from Congo and a convert. She has a job, but the church helps her with her food. Members also come to her home to help her learn English.
I feel good. Yeah, they help me for everything. I have a problem, they help me.
They do need to work for what they receive.
Unless they can't.
If they're physically unable or they can't work for what they receive, then yeah, we make accommodations.
Cindy Trishman is a Church Relief Society president, an unpaid appointed position always held by a woman. She volunteers many hours a week helping members and non-members get their lives back in order. Here in the Bishop Storehouse, she's helping a member choose groceries. There are 115 Bishop Storehouses around the country.
It's important for people to not feel hungry when they're trying to think of getting a job or when they're trying to think of getting a home.
Other helpers here include Wilma and Devon Schofield. They're on what is called a service mission, which typically lasts a year and a half.
Makes you feel good when somebody comes in and they get a real small order and they're crying all the way out the door because they have something for the night.
Whether it's in the bakery, the cheese factory, or the thrift store, volunteers are everywhere. Head of production and distribution, Don Johnson.
Just in our production and distribution activities, we have over 1.5 million hours of volunteer service. And we could not do this without those volunteers.
Hi.
Lay pastors like Paul Roberts are called bishops. They're the linchpins of the welfare system. If a family needs help, they call the bishop. He's the man.
And we work with people to help them get back on their feet. So sometimes they need temporary assistance, like they'll need a food order or they'll need some utilities paid for. We stand ready to help.
Sonny Cisneros doesn't go to church much, but with a baby on the way and unexpected medical bills, the bishop stepped in to help out.
It's good food for a whole month or so. So yeah, I'm very grateful and thankful for it.
This is Welfare Square near downtown Salt Lake City. It includes a job training center, grocery store, bakery, and a secondhand store called Deseret Industries. It's the hub of the program, easy to spot by the towering grain silo.
Okay, you see behind me here a grain storage facility, which happens to be one of 29 that we have in the church. This holds our strategic grain reserve. This particular one, which is our oldest facility, holds 16 million pounds of hard red winter wheat.
Much of the welfare system for members is funded by what are called fast offerings. These are donations from families who fast for two meals one Sunday each month and give the equivalent amount of money to the ward bishop. The humanitarian fund comes from separate contributions and is almost always for non-members.
We're sending aid to certainly to Western Europe, but we also have projects that are going on in Africa. We have projects that are going on in the Middle East where we're providing aid for the refugee camps in Turkey for people that have come out of Syria and Iraq, same thing in Jordan.
That would also include local aid to some of the faith-based clinics and homeless shelters in and around Salt Lake City. Laurel Ingham is with the 4th Street Clinic, funded mostly by the government and intended only for the homeless. The clinic also receives aid each year from the church.
I think the welfare program is truly amazing. Truly amazing. I mean, we are really given a gift. It's very much a donation. Use it where you want. Use it where it can best be used. We have reporting back to them to say this is how much we've used. Right. This is how many people have been served. But beyond that, there is no strings for us attached whatsoever.
This is a Bishop Central storehouse. It's huge, over 500,000 square feet, built to withstand the 7.5 earthquake. Everything goes through here to the smaller 114 storehouses around the country. There are enough provisions to meet the projected demands of members and non-members in the U.S. and Canada for 2 years.
When we look at the products throughout this building, 80% of the product is produced and packaged by the church.
John Hopkins is the manager of this operation. First, he takes me through the refrigeration area, which is larger than a football field.
This is negative 13 Fahrenheit.
Wow, I believe it.
Yeah. What you're seeing here is meat storage, and it's about 4 to 6 months of inventory. In this facility, we have 65,000 pallet spaces. It's approximately 2,700 truckloads.
There are no strings attached to this. It's not because they're members or because we feel some obligation because of their beliefs that we help them. This is aid that we give to anybody just because they're in need, and we feel that it's the right thing to do.
As the church continues to grow, the need will get even greater, especially since most of the growth is in Central and South America and Africa. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Salt Lake City.
We have a story today from Fred DeSam Lazaro on the achievements of a group of Quakers who helped develop Costa Rica in Central America. Back in the 1950s, when young men were still being drafted for military service, some of them in Alabama decided their religious commitment to peace and nonviolence prevented them from bearing arms. So they moved with their families to Costa Rica, where their settlement helped that country become one of the world's most popular destinations for ecotourists, 250,000 of them a year.
For decades, Costa Rica has invited tourists to enjoy its natural beauty and use their dollars to conserve it. One of the deepest roots of this ecotourism traces back to a group of American Quakers. They arrived in the 1950s and carved out a community they called Monteverde, or Green Mountain, a town and cloud forest reserve that form one of the best-known tourist spots in this Central American nation. Today, the influence of Quakers can be seen in local produce and food that's on the grocery store shelves, in the recreation at the Friends School and Center, which is a social hub for the larger community of Costa Ricans and settlers. Over time, the number of original Quaker pioneers has dwindled to a relative handful. At Sunday services, there is no priest or leader, no sermon, no music, as is typical for many Quaker congregations. It's called a meeting and mostly conducted in silence.
Well, a basic tenet, I think, of Quaker faith is the belief, the strong belief, there is that of God in every person. That if you sit in silence and listen, that you can be led by the Spirit.
Lucille, or Lucky Gwinden, was among the earliest arrivals here, led on an extraordinary journey by another basic tenet of Quaker faith, which goes back to 17th century England. That's pacifism.
All men between 18 and 25 will be required to register. I repeat.
Back in 1948, the U.S. reinstituted the draft, requiring all young men to sign up. Lucky Gwinden's husband-to-be, Wolf, resisted. When we visited, Wolf Gwinden was in poor health and unable to speak. He died just 4 weeks later. Another resistor from Alabama, Marvin Rockwell, now 93, said they were willing to face the consequences.
We were arrested and sentenced to a year and a day in prison. We were actually in prison for a third of the sentence, out on parole of balance.
Far more influential than prison was a piece of advice given to them at sentencing by the judge in that Alabama court.
He said, if you can't obey the laws of this country, then you should look for another one. So that planted a seed.
Rockwell, Gwinden, and two other resistors, joined by other families from Fairhope, Alabama, 44 people in all, decided to find a new country, unable to reconcile their beliefs with a system that they believed was preparing the United States for the next war. Costa Rica was a natural fit. It was encouraging immigration and in 1949 abolished its army.
It was also a country with mostly middle class, not the extreme rich and the extreme poor. And they were also welcoming people to come in and help develop it. So when my husband-to-be wrote to me, how would I like to live in Costa Rica? Of course.
You'd grown up in Iowa.
I grew up in Iowa.
The Costa Rica they chose to live in could not be more different than Iowa or Alabama. With proceeds from the sale of land back home, they purchased some 3,400 acres in a lush tropical mountainscape. The road here, treacherous even today, well, they had to build it.
The road, when we first came, well, like I said, was an ox cart trail. You had to have four-wheel drive, chains,
Maybe carry an extra axle with you and have a winch. And even then, sometimes the oxen had to, people had to get pulled out by oxen. But
there was no clinic. The community counted on faith and, ironically, the military experience of Marvin Rockwell.
In the Second World War, I was drafted and wouldn't carry a rifle, so they put me in the medical corps, which was the training I got was very valuable here because when we first got here, the closest doctor was Punta Arenas, 6 hours away by jeep.
In time, a school and community center were built, land was cleared, and farms established. The Gwindons went on to have 9 children. Their dairy farm is now operated by son Benito Gwindon. Together, international conservation groups in the Quaker community, led by Wolf Gwindon, agreed to protect the forest from mining, logging, or even further human encroachment.
Wolf spent the first 20 years of his life cutting down trees and the rest of his life saving trees, so.
The Quakers themselves contributed a third of the acres they'd purchased earlier toward the Cloud Forest Reserve. Today, some 250,000 eco-tourists visit here each year. A smaller number of North Americans have come and stayed. Hawaii native Nicolette Smith settled here with her husband, Randall.
Didn't take us long at all to realize this is the perfect place to have kids. I mean, they're growing up a lot like I did in Hilo, a small town, you know, where everybody knows who you are.
For the Smiths, the Friends School and Center quickly became a social hub to meet others, a place for cultural events as well as religious observances. Many of those who attend Sunday services are not Quaker.
We're not out to convert anybody. There are branches of Quakerism where that's what they do, but we not our branch. And so to live peaceably, to work with and cooperatively.
While Quakers draw on biblical scriptures, their belief system is inherently ecumenical, founded amid religious turmoil in 17th century England. Quakerism's founders believed in direct communion with God, although some branches do have programmed services with Bible readings. After months of attending for mostly social reasons, the Smiths decided to do so for spiritual ones and become Quakers.
I'm looking for a place to practice empathy. I'm looking for a place to practice tolerance. I'm looking for a place to practice compassion, love, truth. What I found in the Friends community is a place to do that is safe, that is a very large tent. Now, the great part of that was that I ended up joining the most organized religion I could find.
One whose adherents, numbering just a few dozen, have left a large civic footprint in Costa Rica, long known as one of the most peaceful nations in this hemisphere. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred de Sam Lazaro in Monteverde, Costa Rica.
Finally, Muslims have been observing Ramadan when they fast from sunup to sundown. During the month, many mosques around the country encourage members to invite non-Muslim friends to the special iftar dinner that breaks their fasting. Imam Johari Abdul Malik of the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, described how the Bring a Friend to Mosque project helps build bridges.
There are many people who have never been in a mosque before. Even though they work with Muslims, they live near Muslims, they pass by the mosque all the time. But there's something foreboding about going into a house of worship that you don't know what the traditions are. But there is a curiosity. We discovered that if we told members of the congregation, invite your friend, and we have in this mosque about 1,000 people for dinner every night. So, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 extra people, it's not gonna make a difference for us. Our friends and neighbors will also come because they will share their traditions with us. What I learned after 30 years of interfaith dialogue is that when people come together and share their faith traditions, they are more likely to deepen the tradition that they're in than they are to join another. And so it is through that deepening that all of us grow.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, scenes from this week's International Yoga Day.
Sarve Bhadra.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.